Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This movement, music, moving to it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word.
Any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussy-footing, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfuckers up made me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they've fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
And improve Your World News intro. I hope you guys like it. Stepping up to the 21st century. I guess that means we're big time now. We got our own Your World News musical interlude, done by DJ Tony Drake, otherwise known as Anthony Lambert. So shout out to him for putting that together for us. You know, collection of everything from the Guru and Gangstar, Immortal Technique, you know, brother Malcolm X, El Hajj Malik, El Shabazz, I mean, that's Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. We don't front. We don't claim to not have opinions. We don't claim to be unbiased. You know, we are biased. We're biased towards social activism. We are biased, heavily biased towards social justice. And, you know, we are biased towards peace, love, unity, and having fun. Yeah. And maybe not so much the fun part anymore. It's time for business. And that's what we're about. It's time for business. In this day and age right now, a day and age of run and ruled by kleptocrats and institutional racism and white supremacy, we got to pull up our, we have to pull up our jeans, our britches, pull up our sleeves to our shirts and get ready to get down and dirty, because that's what it's going to take to change this society, change this world, to be one that is much more equitable, that is free and completely free of white supremacy and institutional racism, free of this capitalist structure that continues to pimp and prod and suck the lifeblood out of society and those most vulnerable. Matter of fact, people are most vulnerable because of capitalism, because of institutional racism, because of sexism, and some of these other isms. Not all isms are not bad. You know, Pan-Africanism is not a bad thing. You know, feminism is not a bad thing. Activism is not a bad thing, as long as it's the right kind of activism towards social justice. So anyways, I'm your host, Solomon. Some may call me Solo. And I'm joined also by Miss Madam Andrea Zamudio. It's been way too long, folks. It's been way too long. And we've got a hell of a show for you today, We have a special guest, Dr. Margaret Flowers, who will be joining us soon. And she's going to be talking about this important movement that is going to be taking place at Freedom Plaza in Washington, D.C. on October 6, 2011, a takeover, replication of what we saw in Tahrir Square in Egypt. She's one of the major organizers for the October2011.org, the October movement. You can just go to October2011.org. She's also a medical doctor. She's an MD, a real MD. She doesn't play one on TV like Dewey Houser or House. She's a real MD. She's a pediatrician, and she's my kind of pediatrician because she believes in a single-payer system, and she's a social activist. I would think she would say that probably first and foremost, and that influences the work that she does. She believes in a single-payer healthcare system. She's based out of Baltimore, Maryland, and she's served as the Congressional Fellow for Physicians for a National Healthcare Program, because that's something the mainstream media did not tell you about in 2010 and before that there are literally tens of thousands of doctors coast to coast that support a single-payer healthcare program. So she'll be joining us at about half past, so in about another 19, 20 minutes or so. Andrea, you're on the show. Welcome back. It's just been a long time. Been rested. I sound fresh because I'm feeling fresh. I'm feeling rejuvenated, and I'm sure you are. What are your thoughts about the world we live in?
Yeah, it's great to be with you. I'm just really excited to talk to Dr. Flowers, particularly about this movement that's going to be happening in October. I know that they've put out a letter stating that it was motivated and inspired by the movement occurring in the Middle East and North Africa, and so. I'm definitely looking forward to that. I would love for her to expand on what the demands are, what exactly is this movement trying to get from the government, and so that all the listeners, can get pumped up and ready to be involved in October.
Right, right. And I don't know if you have any initial thoughts. I mean, we see today that big surprise, the Dow, Wall Street, drops more than 440 points, and the world's largest casino, otherwise known as Wall Street, you know, casino where they play with the lives of many folks, where we see securities-backed assets where basically are stocks that are based on people's debt, based on people's debt. Imagine that. And all supplied, all financed by the U.S. Capitalist system. What a system it is. It's a rapacious system that's taken a lot of lives, and it is economic terrorism at its finest or at its worst. And so, that's the news that we see today. Those are some of the headlines that a lot of folks are talking about today. But also other headlines, you know, we know that more people are on food stamps than ever before. The real unemployment rate hovers around 20%. I'm talking about the real unemployment rate, not what is being reported by the corporate media, not the 9.2%, 9.8%. We're talking about the real unemployment rate, which doesn't include the underemployed rate. Andrea, these things are running amok. This is something, and it's spiraling out of control. And I, as I said back in 2010, I said things are unfortunately going to get much worse. And we see things are getting much worse. We see this whole debt ceiling bullcrap. Despite the fact that the debt ceiling since the 40s has been raised, you know, about 90 times, we see the whole subterfuge, and we see a phenotypically brown-skinned president who has played, unfortunately, a lot of his constituents for fools, and they seem to like being Andre. People that continue to support Obama, they continue to act like a bunch of fools. They really do. I mean, continue to support this fool and more worried about this guy's reputation and how he looks. How he might look in front of Republicans, and so therefore they're not going to question him because they don't want to embarrass him. But at the same time, Andre, he has no problem embarrassing and disrespecting the poor in this country, black and brown folks. He has no problem whatsoever putting up. And Andre, and I'll end on this. You know, we see with this so-called, you know, we'll talk more about this with Dr. Flowers, is that what's interesting is that the Republicans got so much of what they wanted. There's no tax increases on the uber rich and the major corporations. $2.5 trillion plus going to be cut in so-called entitlement programs. I even hate that word, entitlement programs, but valuable social programs such as Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Are on the chopping block, and it's going to have a catastrophic effect on the working class and poor in this country. And Obama bends over, has no problem being you know, obsequious, and just because, you know what, Andrea, he bows down to the large corporations that got him in power in the first place. They're the ones that are the major financiers of his campaign, and so I don't know what your thoughts are, Andre. Any thoughts on this ominous cloud that is hovering over America and the broader world?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this whole notion that Obama, you know, needs to be protected for the sake of his reputation is just something that really speaks to the media in this country and how they don't. You know, they're not really putting out the appropriate information regarding the issues that are happening. And I think that people, the majority of people, you know, they don't really understand what's happening because a lot of times the way that the media presents it is in a complicated way. And so, you know, for a lot of people, this whole raising the debt ceiling, a lot of the issues that happen, even when the financial crash occurred, people still don't really understand what happened, you know, because what we're fed is just like complicated terms and it's not broken down so that, you know, the everyday person can understand what's happening. So if we can't understand what's occurring, we don't know how to fight back. And so I think that that's where, you know, independent media is so important because it gives the community the opportunity to speak to each other and really break down what's occurring and how we can fight back and get what we need.
I couldn't agree more. I couldn't agree more. And that's why it's so important to organize and to mobilize, because there's a lot of stuff going on right now, including this awful drought that is going on in Somalia. And I want to play this piece by Glenn Ford. There's a terrible drought that's going on in Somalia, and is having catastrophic impact on the people in Somalia. And when we look at the root of it, you know, those of us that know history know that you know, the Somalian, Somalia has been touched up by the U.S. interference, through the CIA and USAID for a long time, going back to the mid-60s, late-60s, early-70s. And all the way through, not just Black Hawk Down, but even now, as the U.S. continues to meddle in those affairs, and not from a good perspective. The U.S. is waging war. They're having drone strikes in Somalia as we speak. Have a secret CIA prison, that is financed and supported by the CIA. So I want to touch on this drought because it needs to be thought of by humanitarians across the world, and keep these people not just in our thoughts but also in our collective actions in terms of figuring out what we can do to help support some relief to these folks. But this is a very, very on-point piece by Glenn Ford from Black Agenda Report, Somalia Crisis.
Even as U.S. militarization of the Horn of Africa has contributed massively to the threatened starvation of millions, the Americans have announced an escalation of drone attacks against Somalia and the establishment of a marine task force for the region. A United Nations spokesman describes the food and refugee emergency in Somalia as the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, with millions at immediate risk. Not coincidentally, the epicenter of the disaster is the area where Somalia, Kenya, and Ethiopia meet, which is also the focus of U.S. Special Forces, surveillance, and logistics activity. The Americans blame the Al-Shabaab resistance for exacerbating the drought emergency. But for at least 2 years, the Americans have used food as a weapon of war in Somalia, in an effort to starve out those who might be supporting the Shabaab. The U.S. has armed an array of militias operating near the Ethiopian and Kenyan borders, making normal agricultural pursuits all but impossible, and the current world-class catastrophe inevitable. Wherever the U.S. ratchets up its armed interventions in Somalia, disaster follows. 4 years ago, after the Americans instigated an Ethiopian invasion of Somalia to overthrow an Islamist government that had brought a semblance of peace to the region, it set off what the United Nations then called the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa, worse than Darfur. Today, many of those same refugees are confronted with the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet, once again, largely courtesy of the United States. The original crime, the one from which all the other horrors flow, was the theft of Somalia's government and the crushing of its people's dreams for peace. The American proxy aggression, largely conducted through Ethiopia and now Kenya, and much of it directed from Djibouti, the actual headquarters of the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, is the root cause of the social disintegration of Somalia, which has pushed much of the population to the edge of extinction. These are the crimes against humanity that international courts should be prosecuting. Instead, the International Criminal Court has become a tool of the aggressor, and even proposes to deploy the U.S. military as its deputies to enforce its warrants. Justice turned upside down. The newly activated Marine Task Force will augment America's stepped-up drone attacks against the Shabaab, an escalation of Obama's second shooting war in Africa, and war number 6 globally. In addition to the Marines and the drones, The U.S. recently committed $45 million to equipment and training for the Ugandan and Burundian soldiers that are all that props up the puppet Somali government in Mogadishu, the capital. The Obama administration has upgraded Somalia and Yemen as hotspots in its endless war-making, claiming al-Qaeda operatives in the region are even more dangerous to the U.S. than their counterparts in Afghanistan and Pakistan, which essentially tells us that al-Qaeda isn't really all that relevant to why America is spreading war and misery all over the planet. What is clear is that the world's greatest humanitarian threat lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And Glenn Ford laying it down, making it plain. There's nothing more to really say to that, but I will. The ends on world's greatest threat to humanitarian relief lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And as I said in a recent piece that I did, the rest of the world knows of the boogeyman, but for some reason Americans are so obsequious to their government and the corporate media that they believe that the boogeyman, their real boogeyman that they need to fear, is brown skin and wears a turban. Andre, your thoughts on that piece by Glenn Ford and Somalia?
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate him breaking the U.S.'s historical role in the issue that's happening now. I feel like usually when something drastic is happening in any country around the world, and it becomes the issue of the day or of the week or of a month in the U.S., people gravitate to, oh, this is happening, and just, you know, how it happened in Libya or when the hurricane happened in Haiti, but there's no context into what role has the U.S. or European countries played in that destruction, and how could it be prevented? You know, usually when something like that happens, people will just say, oh, well, you know, those people weren't prepared, or they're not able to respond appropriately to these, whether it's environmental or political changes, without really understanding how their own country has played a role in this destruction.
Right. There's rarely a narrative that is told not just the corporate media, but it's really a narrative that is told anywhere, that is mentioned anywhere in school systems. And it's a very ominous thought for anyone conscious that is raising a child in America, because if you don't want your child to be a part of that, to basically have humanity robbed from him or her, because the more they learn in the typical U.S. Sanctioned public school system, whether it's in history classes or social studies classes, the better chance they're going to have of not respecting the struggle that indigenous people within this continent have endured since Europeans first invaded. So, you know, they'll continue to grow up to be 15, 16, 17. And will almost damn near fight you if you tell them that, they shouldn't be, supporting, athletic teams that have names like the Redskins and the imagery that goes along with that, because they've been socialized in a way that basically condones racism at its very core. That's what America pumps out. It's the status quo. It's the status quo. And people, and the word Redskin rolls off people's necks. The people's tongue, like a KKK member has the word nigger rolling off, or the word spick rolling off of his or her tongue. The word Redskin is no different. And so it's a very ominous prospect of anyone that has any kind of consciousness to even think about sending their child anywhere near your typical U.S. public educational system, because it promotes institutional racism, war, violence. I mean, we see this movie, you know, the Captain America. We have all these other movies and video games that promote war at their very core. It's very sick, but to on the perspective of the ruling elite that run America, it's a beautiful thing because it's a wonderful propaganda machine for them. It is a wonderful propaganda machine. Am I not right?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so it's you know, I don't, that's why unfortunately this program that we have here is not, we don't have tens of millions of potential listeners or viewers, as does an MSNBC program that has the Reverend Al Sharpton and having Reverend Al, so we have a black face there, and that means it's all good. Reverend Al, who likes to accept that corporate money from charter schools on behalf of charter schools, and to run with rabid white nationalists like Newt Gingrich, you know, but it's MSNBC, and so we're fooled. Yeah, what you know, it's a black face. So listen to this.
Is Reverend Al Sharpton's move to a primetime slot on MSNBC television a good thing for black people? There was a time, two generations ago, when the placement of just about any black personality in front of the TV cameras was assumed to be a pure plus. That is, unless that person somehow embarrassed the race in full view of white people. But that was before whites with power learned how to put black faces to corporate use. They discovered that there were plenty of African Americans that were so eager to be on television, they would say anything. These aspiring anchors would read news copy full of racist code words like forced busing without complaint, glad to get the check and to be on the tube. The news didn't really get any better in terms of its treatment of black people and the issues that mattered most to the African American community. In fact, it's generally gotten worse. But the presence of black faces on the screen created the illusion that television's news content was now friendlier and more relevant to blacks. Lots of black folks are still playing that face-counting game, and for them, MSNBC's decision to put Al Sharpton out front at 6 p.m. is a sign of black progress, maybe even a kind of coup. Look at Reverend Al. He used to take it to the streets to challenge authority, and now he's the authority, holding down a prime time spot. That must be good for black people, right? Wrong. MSNBC's choice of Sharpton over the leftish young Turkish-American Cenk Uygur is a net loss for everyone outside the orbits of power. Al Sharpton is President Obama's paid pit bull, whose main mission is to maul and mangle any black politicians and activists that might consider leaving the Obama reservation. He's been bankrolled by billionaire New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's running black and brown folks out of the Big Apple as fast as hyper-gentrification will allow. Sharpton, always buyable and never trustworthy, has completed his biggest deal yet with power, Wall Street power, and the power of a White House that serves Wall Street. He's nestled in the bosom of the rulers and will savage anyone that tries to mess with his sugar daddies, Obama and Bloomberg. So how do black people or anyone else seeking to understand reality benefit from having Obama's pit bull and Mayor Bloomberg's pet taking up space on the MSNBC set every night? Who will be better off when Reverend Al hosts Obama administration officials or even the president himself on his show? Reverend Al's not going to put forward any questions worth asking. That would violate his terms of service to Obama and to Wall Street. No, all we will get from Sharpton is a demand that blacks build a wall around President Obama to keep him safe and secure in the White House for another term, no matter how much of the social safety net he signs away forever. the young Turkish-American Cenk Uygur showed that he could be counted on to confront the Obama administration on questions of policy. That's why he was replaced with the mercenary Al Sharpton. So, we will have our black face at 6 p.m. Some African Americans think what's most important is to have black role models on TV for the sake of the children. That's what's so scary. Al Sharpton, the eminently viable man, a role model for black kids. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, Andre, I want to get your thoughts on that. I want to get your thoughts, first and foremost, on that piece that we just played.
So, you know, I think Glenn Ford's completely on point. It's very confusing for people now. It seems that when they see whether it's a black or brown person speaking, they just assume that that person has their best interest in hand, and they don't question, you know, what their motives are or who they're being funded by, and I think it's so dangerous. And I think that that's I think the best example right now is Obama. You know, he's done so many things beyond what George Bush did, but you know, has very little criticism from the left regarding, you know, these same policies that he's pushed. And so I think that it's important for us to remember that. I think that when Dr. King was speaking about once you know, being judged by the content of your character, he also meant in terms of, you know, if you are a black or brown person and you are doing things that perpetuate racism and white supremacy, then you should be judged on that. And I don't think that you know, that quote is usually taken that way, but I think that we need to start seeing it like that. We cannot allow how someone looks to define how we see them without really putting an effort into questioning what their motives are.
Right, right. And, you know, you're exactly right. And as we know, Sharpton is on the Obama payroll. Sharpton is on the White House payroll. He is a hired, you know, pit bull for Obama, as was mentioned earlier. And, you know, and that's why he won't say a damn thing. It was just it was so interesting, you know, having, you know, that little, you know, interesting, I don't know, what's it called, that little, you know, little threat between he and Cornel West when they were on that panel, and it has been going on, you know, having the two of them go back and forth. But it was just interesting when Cornel West was asking Sharpton, you know, like basically, you know, these are all the things that Obama has done. I mean, can you not say anything, critical? You know, even constructively critical about, you know, Obama's moves and his support and his continued alliance with corporate oligarchs. And it was just interesting. Like Sharpton, it was, I mean, even when pressed, would not say a damn thing. And, you know, it's not a secret anymore that he's on the payroll of the White House and has aligned himself, and so he's among the most dangerous, along with some of the most dangerous to the psyche of black people nationwide, because far too many black people think, as you said, Andrea, you know, look at the phenotypical skin color of some of these individuals and just believe that, you know, because they are that skin color, that it's okay they're to be trusted, without them actually, you know, thinking critically or honing the skills that are required to think critically and looking beyond the veil. You know, the same thing goes with Tom Joyner and Michael Bazin. I mean, they're very, very deleterious to the psyche of African people in this country, the people of African ancestry. So, anyways, but without further ado, I see that we do have Dr. Flowers on the line. I'm going to put her on in one moment, and I just want to reiterate, Dr. Margaret Flowers is my kind of doctor. She's a pediatrician based out of Baltimore. So it's not just that she's a pediatrician based out of Baltimore, about 40 minutes from where Andrea and I have our underground cavernous studio, you know, and I say underground, you know, from the standpoint of not literally underground, but underground, like almost like the Underground Railroad, because our message has been is the kind of message that is consistently being suppressed by the corporate media and the dominant hegemony that tries to control much of the political consent and dissent in this country. But she's my kind of doctor because she's an activist, which I think defines the way she practices medicine. She believes in a single-payer healthcare system, everybody in and nobody out. That's not the kind of healthcare that Barack Obama believes in. That is not the kind of healthcare that he and many of his constituents believe in. We don't have to mention the Republicans. We know what they are. They, of course, they don't believe in a single-payer healthcare system. All right? Meanwhile, other countries throughout the world, whether it's Germany or Norway, Venezuela, Cuba, they have single-payer healthcare. And so we're gonna talk to Dr. Flowers about that, but we're also going to talk about the fact that there's a major movement in Washington, D.C. that's coming. There's a major movement called the October 2011 movement. And as I said before, go to October2011.org. She's one of the major organizers, one of the core organizers for that movement. She's also has served as a congressional fellow for physicians for a national healthcare program. I mentioned that to you as well, that the corporate media will not tell you this, but there are literally tens of thousands of doctors in this country that believe in a single-payer healthcare system. You know, just like there are scores of nurses, like the California Nurses Association, I mean, that believe in a single-payer healthcare system. And she's also on the board of Healthcare Now. So she's going to be talking to us about those things, and I'm looking forward to it because this is a really important dialogue because we cannot talk about what is going on in this country. We cannot talk about the war and the trillions of dollars that have been spent on these wars, the more than $1 trillion that have been spent on these wars, that are continued to be spent on these wars and destroying human life, without talking about healthcare. Of course, we're going to talk about a doctor because doctors are supposed to save lives while the U.S. military takes lives and robs lives and takes lives away, but also the money that is being pumped into dropping missiles and everywhere from Libya to drone attacks and in Yemen and Somalia and obviously Central Asia. Meanwhile, that money is being siphoned away to kill people. That money could be going towards a single-payer healthcare system and a single-payer healthcare system that, by the way, would save upfront about $400 million. And so she's going to put that in a deeper perspective. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Margaret Flowers, who's my kind of doctor and also our co-host, Andrea's kind of doctor. Dr. Flowers, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, Solomon. Thank you for having me on tonight.
Oh, no problem. No problem whatsoever. Dr. Flowers, I wanted to start off with a question about what's going on October 6, 2011. If you could tell us what this movement is about, what it's going to entail, and why, quite frankly, people are listening for the first time now or are listening on the archive, why they should be concerned and why they should join alliances with yourself and as well as Your World News, who is we're proud to support this movement.
Thank you. Well, this is really a movement that every person in the United States needs to get involved in. You know, just every day that's proven more and more that now is the time to stand up and demand real change. During my work for single payer, it became very clear that the policy was not about the evidence of what works and what doesn't work. It's decided based on the influence of the industries that are currently profiting off of the situation, and those would be the insurance industries and pharmaceutical. And so it's very hard for the single-payer movement to be strong enough, even though we represent the majority opinion in the United States, to overcome the power of that very powerful industry. And other movements for peace and social, economic, environmental justice for human rights, they face the same obstacle that this broken political process, this corporate media that misinforms the public, keeps these common sense, evidence-based solutions from being put into place. So the October 2011 movement is something that's going to, it's a new movement that's going to change that. And we decided that we needed to come together and join our forces and our strengths and do something different beyond the one-day rallies and the protests that we all go to and then we go home. We're in such a crisis situation that we can no longer just do those types of limited actions. So we brought together leaders from various movements for economic, environmental, social justice, for peace, for human rights, immigrants' rights, and we're going to Washington, D.C. on October 6th to Freedom Plaza. It's between the White House and the Capitol, and we're going to occupy that space, and some of us who are willing and able are going to engage in acts of nonviolent resistance. But we're going to stay there and put pressure on the system and disrupt what's going on. And like our brothers and sisters around the world and around the country and other capitals have done, we're going to stay and demand that changes be put into place. So I do hope that your listeners, especially since we're so close to Washington, D.C., that they will join us for as much of the occupation as they can, or if they can't join us, please support us in other ways. We're going to need supplies and donations to help us continue through this occupation.
Right, and how far are you willing to take it, the occupation? Because I understand, like, you know, talking with you off air, that this is, and looking at the website, this is a collection of folks who have been inspired by what happened in Tahrir Square.
Right.
You know, and those folks were out there for literally, you know, weeks.
Right, and actually we had a Skype call today with some of the protesters from Tahrir Square because we are acting in solidarity with movements around the world. This is really a global demand. We were talking about today, you know, what were the primary issues that we felt unity around, and there's so many common issues, U.S. militarism and how that affects foreign policy around the world, the need for jobs, education and healthcare, economic stability. All of these countries are yearning for the same things but facing the similar types of obstacles. So it's really very exciting. We are engaged in this movement for as long as it takes. Crisis situation in this nation on so many levels, and we've identified 15 core areas on our website that we need to address. And we know that we can't just elect the right people. We can't send emails to change things. It's time to actually put our bodies out there and demand these changes, and that's going to be a long process. So we're committed to stay there in the square as long as we need to stay there. And then once moving in a direction that's favorable, we may choose to disband the camp, but we're not going to stop organizing and pressuring until our country is turned around.
Right. Andrea.
Dr. Flowers, I wanted to ask you, with some of the movements in the Middle East and in North Africa, the goal has been to, you know, oust the president or change the political system and make it more democratic. And although a lot of people believe that in this country we have democracy, I think that the three of us would agree, and many of our listeners would agree, that that's not exactly the case given corporate interests. So my question is, how would what is the end result from this movement and the occupation at Freedom Plaza that you guys would like to see? Is it changing the political structure of this country, making it perhaps more favorable to third parties being included in the political process?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's one area of fundamental change that we require in this nation because, as you know, both the Republican and Democratic parties are corporate parties, and they're really ruled by Wall Street and the industries and not acting in the interest of the people. I would say they're acting against the interest of the majority of the American people, and that's a problem. So we're trying not to dictate this too much from ourselves, because this needs to be a people-led movement, and people need to see themselves as empowered. We cannot just think any longer that we elect the right leader and that's all we need to do. We've got to create this change ourselves. So a big part of about the solutions, about things that people can do in their daily lives to help move us in the correct, you know, proper direction, but also bringing people into the discussion. And so like the protesters in Spain, we'll be having nightly assemblies. We hope to be able to live stream so that others can hear what we're saying and can participate. And we imagine that out of this, we will break into working groups who will work on particular issues and continue to push for changes around those issues that we require.
And what's the best way people can support this, Dr. Flowers, and also getting more information about this, and if they, you know, choose to support, you know, just generally support this this important event?
There are many ways that people can support this. The first way would be to go to our website, october2011.org, and you can register there. You can either sign the pledge that says that you will join us, and the pledge says that you'll join us when you can. If you can't be there on the 6th, which is a Thursday, join us on the weekend or Friday night if you need to. If you can only come for a few days, that's okay. Or if you are not able, you really are not able to physically be in Washington, D.C. with us, you can join the online community and participate in our discussions on the website. We have a number of different fora going on where people are discussing issues and educating each other, and those are important conversations. We also require donations. This is all being organized by individual people. And although we have organizations that have endorsed the action, a few of them have made donations, but really we're doing this full-time just because it needs to be done. And we will need to purchase supplies and things for the occupation, for our medical tent and our food tent and those types of things. So if people can donate, that's great. Help us spread the word, recruit your organization. You can help out with housing people who might need a place to stay for a night or two when they're coming into town, or maybe they need a place to take a shower. All of these things would be helpful to us.
Right, and we're proud to support, and we look forward to being out there on October 7th ourselves, Andre and myself. Dr. Flowers, I wanted to transition. I wanted to ask you a question. What was actually not really a transition, because what I'm about to ask you is so intricately linked to what October 6th is about, and the funds that are continually diverted towards this war, this being the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan.
Right.
What, from your origins as a medical professional, what was the, I guess, I don't know, what was the watershed moment in your life or your career that led you to be somebody that just thought it was best that there needs to be a single-payer healthcare system in this country? What led you to that, and why?
Well, it was really, you know, like most things, it's a process, but there was kind of that wake-up moment. And for me, it was, you know, when I went to college, I was top of my class. I graduated from medical school with honors. I went to Johns Hopkins to do my residency. I was really excited when I finished my residency training to go out and practice what I thought would be good quality medicine and be able to take care of my patients, and kept running into the same obstacle that made it more difficult to provide quality care in this country, and that was the private insurance industry, because they operate on a completely different model. It's an opposite model to what medicine should be about. They're required to create profit for their investors, and they do that by not paying for health care, by restricting care and denying care, and that's just not the way it works. So as a private practitioner, you know, in a community practice, we were really struggling with these insurance companies to provide care. And what more and more practices were doing was to adopt a model of seeing more and more patients and spending less time with them. And if a patient has more than one complaint, you're supposed to ask them to schedule a separate appointment for the other complaints rather than addressing everything in one visit. And when it came down to, you know, we were being told that was how we should practice, I just said, I can't do this anymore. That's not the type of medicine that I wanted to practice. And I had been looking prior to that for solutions, and came across Physicians for National Health Program, and their proposal just made so much sense to me. It was all about providing high-quality care and focusing on the needs of the patient and improving the health of the population.
Right. And for those of us that don't know, how much of an influence is the pharmaceutical industry as well as the health insurance industry in terms of shaping and molding these policies that make it so difficult to have a single payer system right now? As an insider, which you are, and I know that you've been even arrested in terms of protesting for a single payer system. How big of an influence are we talking about?
Oh, it's tremendous. I mean, it's the health insurance, the health industrial complex dominates healthcare in this country. You have the pharmaceutical companies are very intrusive through their direct marketing to patients, but also the way that they recruit and pay doctors. They follow doctors' prescription habits and will start, you know, hounding physicians that aren't prescribing their medication enough, or they, you know, they provide doctors with very biased information. And when doctors are practicing and so busy trying to, you know, keep their practices going, it's hard to get reliable information about what medications actually work and what don't. Doctors are pushed to use medications for conditions that those medications weren't really even certified to be used for. And then the health insurance companies have so many ways of, from the beginning, of restricting a patient's ability to get care, whether it's not covering them for certain conditions that they have or not allowing them to see certain doctors or receive certain prescriptions or treatments. I mean, one of the things in practice that I just found remarkable was when I would see a patient and write a prescription and the patient would go to the pharmacy to get the prescription filled, sometimes then the insurance company, you know, I'd get called from the pharmacist that I needed to contact the insurance company to get authorization for the patient to have that medication. Well, you know, when a doctor prescribes a medication for a patient, I thought that was sufficient authorization that, you know, that we're saying the patient needs that medicine. But it's just another step trying to prevent, you know, people from getting what they need or delay it. And it's, you know, it's not good for the health of the patient.
All right. Andrea?
Dr. Flowers, I wanted to ask you if you could explain, just give us an overview of what single payer is exactly, and how feasible it would be to implement, and how long it would take to implement if we were able to get Congress to sign on to this.
Thank you. Yeah, so the easiest way, I think, to think about single payer in this country is to think about traditional Medicare, where in the United States, when somebody reaches the age of 65 or is disabled, they automatically are able to get their Medicare card. It's a nationwide program that's paid for through our taxes, and then those Medicare patients can choose the doctor that they want to see, and it's the doctor and the patient that determine what care they will receive. So we think of it as improved Medicare for all because there are some things in our current Medicare that need to be fixed. For one thing, it's not comprehensive enough. We need to cover dental care, vision care, mental health, long-term prescription. Everything that is really medically necessary should be covered under the health system. And, of course, we have to work around with reimbursement, those types of things, which can be done when we have everybody in the same system. So it's really just a national health program that's universal, everybody in, nobody out, like you said earlier, starts at the time you're born, and when you die, you pay into it through public financing to create a system that's there. So when you have a problem, you decide where you want to go, you walk in, you show them your card. It's really that simple, not a lot of paperwork or barriers, no copays or deductibles, because those actually keep people from getting care. And it creates a system where we can look at the needs of our people, look at the resources that we have, and allocate those resources in the way that we need to do rather than right now. It's very unequal. You know, I guess you're in Prince George's County, is that correct? Has
Yes.
some of the poorest health outcomes and really very poor access to primary care in your community, whereas, you know, right next door in, like, Montgomery County or Howard County, they have, you know, so many services, so many physicians. We need to make those services available to each community that needs them.
Right. Thank you. That was
cool.
Go on, Andrea.
I just wanted to follow up. Do you feel that the current healthcare system is a contributing factor to maintaining inequalities across race and class?
Well, you know, absolutely. And, you know, just the health of our population is very severely affected by, you know, racism and classism. We know that the majority of our health is determined not by access to health care. That's only about 10% of our overall health. 90% is really social determinants. So things like adequate education, a safe environment, healthy food, being treated with dignity, having a job where you're paid a living wage, all of these factors are really important to creating a healthy population. And the U.S. does poorly in all of those areas. We have the greatest degree of wealth inequality. We have the lowest amount of our GDP devoted towards a social infrastructure or social safety net compared to other industrialized nations. And if you look at the indicators of social well-being for this country and compare that to the wealth inequality and compare that to other industrialized nations, we're completely off the chart, abnormal for our indicators of social well-being, with high rates of homicide, low education, you know, just across the board, even trust. We do very poorly in the area of trust, and what does that do to a society? So part of the October action is about stopping corporatism and militarism, but the other part is about creating the society that we need, the peaceful, just, and sustainable society, and empowering people and how to do that and modeling how to do that. How do we become the ones that create this change instead of looking outward for someone else to do it for us?
Right. And Dr. Flowers, I can't avoid asking this question, because one of the things that why so many Americans were scared, basically scared and freaked out about a single-payer health care system, saying that this is just an additional so-called entitlement. I think that's such a insult in and of itself, because health care is a human right. But during the whole debate, so many Americans that should be supporting this, that it would behoove them to support single-payer, if not just for themselves, but for their children, members of their family who desperately would benefit from quality single-payer system. What are the costs? Because, they throw the cost out there, and if I'm not wrong, and I think obviously way better than I can, I think you can provide a context to what kind of relief would a single-payer system have on small businesses. What kind of relief would it have on taxpayers, and also to the this growing unemployment rate that we have here? Like, how many, what kind of jobs are we talking about that a single-payer system could pump back into the system, and all those things? You know, if you could provide some kind of context.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're saying is absolutely correct. Basically, the one area where the United States excels when it comes to health care is the amount of money that we spend. We spend more per person per year on health care than any other industrialized nation. In some cases, it's twice as much, and those countries cover all of their people and have better health outcomes. And the reason we have such high prices is because our health care costs are just rising out of control. We don't have a system that negotiates for fair prices for pharmaceuticals, so we pay the most for those. We don't have a rational system of determining how much health services should cost, so we pay the most for health services compared to other nations, despite the fact that we actually use those services less than other nations do. And so this whole kind of corporate for-profit healthcare is spiraling our healthcare costs out of control. And the only way we can get them under control is to have an actual health system. So there's various pieces of that health system that would control our healthcare costs. One is just administrative simplicity. If we went to a single system where there was one set of rules and one payer, rather than spending a third of our healthcare dollars on all this administrative and marketing, we would spend about 3%. So that means a lot more money going for direct health care, enough to cover everybody. If we were able to negotiate for fair prices, our pharmaceutical costs and medical services costs would be much lower. So that's the way that we can rein in these costs. And then the other piece is that we have numerous studies that show that we could have a national comprehensive universal healthcare system for the same amount of money that we're currently spending or less. And then when you talk about businesses, healthcare is one of the biggest drivers of our, you know, deficit and our, you know, problems in this country. Wages have been stagnant for decades in this country as a result of rising health care costs and workers losing, you know, just trying to hang on to the health benefits they have, lose the raises that they could otherwise have. Small businesses bear a huge burden when it comes to paying for health insurance premiums, and that means that they go out of business often from health care costs, or you have someone who would like to open a business, but they're afraid to do that because they might lose their health care benefits in their current job. They don't feel like they can take that risk. And then it affects our ability to compete on the global market when we go against other nations where their health care costs are so much lower. And that, you know, that gets factored in. The health care costs get factored into the cost of goods. So, you know, when it comes to cars, I think the GM spends more on health care than they do on steel for the vehicles that they make. Starbucks spends more on health care than they do on the coffee beans that they have. So this would be a huge boon to industry as well. And you know, I testified before the National Commission for Fiscal Responsibility and Reform last summer and, you know, laid all of this data out for them. But we could, if we had our health care costs in line with what other nations were spending, we would have no deficit right now. Zero.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's something I had no idea, that last tidbit of information that you put. So we would have no deficit. A single-payer system could and would contribute to zero deficit in the U.S. economy.
Right, yeah. Dean Baker from the Center for Economic CEPR, I can't remember now what it stands for, he has a great chart that shows U.S. healthcare costs and then what would happen with our deficit if we were in line with what other industrialized nations have. And remember that they cover everybody and they have better health outcomes and higher satisfaction rates from both the patients and their health professionals because they're focused on providing health care.
Right, yeah. Right. And to follow that up, would you say that a strong single-payer system in this country would also contribute to because what I've seen is, you know, and I haven't traveled extensively throughout the world, but I've been to enough countries that have a single-payer system, and, you know, such as, you know, I've actually was in Norway last year. Coincidentally, it's in the news now, but I was in Norway last year. And, you know, that's a country where it's they have a single-payer system, but, and I spoke to dozens and dozens of native Norwegians, and it's a system there that's largely predicated on prevention because they feel that prevention, if they can, prevent people from getting diabetes and so forth, it's going to save them money since it is a single-payer system on the back end. And here it's almost like the completely opposite. See, there's like literally billions of dollars in pharmaceuticals that are being doled out to people that are diabetic, that have heart issues, that have this, that, the other things that are, you know, contributed by a lack of exercise, lack of diet. But even in Cuba, you know, where we see communities having community doctors going there and checking up on people several times a calendar year, and to make sure that people are staying healthy and preventing. Do you think that a single payer system would also be conducive to just a more healthy general population than the U.S.?
Well, absolutely, and the evidence would bear that out, that countries that have a national health program that's publicly funded, their policy is affected by that. It's driven by that. So if you look at Norway is a great example where a while back they had high rates of cardiovascular disease. So their way to approach that was to build more walking paths and educate people about proper diet, and that reduced their incidence of heart disease there. In Europe, they passed legislation to take toxins out of their consumer products. You have to actually prove that a chemical is safe before you put it in a product. That's the opposite of what happens here. And a large part of that was driven by the fact that they would save so much money in their health systems from not having to pay for the health effects of those toxins. So a national health program, you know, it would drive, you know, our public transportation, our food. You know, if you look at the amount of high fructose corn syrup here in the United States, I have three teenagers. I work really hard when I go to the store to find products without high fructose corn syrup. In Europe, you can't really find things with high fructose corn syrup there. So we think that it would really drive our country in the direction of better public health policy.
Right. Andrea?
I wanted to ask you what the response from the Obama administration has been, just in general, to physicians who are for single-payer healthcare, and to you particularly, because I know that, as we mentioned earlier in the show, you had been arrested trying to, you know, present a letter to President Obama.
Right. You know, it's really interesting because one of the co-founders of Physicians for National Health Program, Dr. Quentin Young, who's an amazing man, he was one of the co-founders of the Medical Committee for Human Rights and had marched along with Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Chicago when he was there and took care of him when he was there. And his partner, Dr. David Shiner, was President Obama's personal physician for 22 years when he was in Chicago. And so when President Obama was a state senator, not only was he very familiar with what single payer was and supported it, he even campaigned with Dr. Young on healthcare as a human right in that area. So he knows what it is, but when it came to us trying to be heard, Physicians for National Health Program, we joined with a number of other groups early on in the health reform process. The California Nurses, you mentioned, was one of those groups. And we were meeting with leadership in Congress and saying, you know, as we move forward, would you just include the single-payer legislation and compare that to what you're putting together on the basis of how many people are covered and what the cost would be, because we knew that ours would be superior. And as they moved into the process of committees, they started excluding us. And so that was the first arrest for me, was in May of 2009 in the Senate Finance Committee with seven other people. Two of them were also Maryland doctors, two were Maryland lawyers, where we stood up and said, you know, why were you not allowing a single payer to be at the table when you're letting all these industry people be there? And then when President Obama, we tried over and over to get meetings with him, to bring delegations of physicians to meet with him. We were refused by the White House. He would meet with doctors from the Doctors for America, which is came out of a group of doctors that supported his campaign. It was called Doctors for Obama. They were allowed to come to the White House, but we were not. And we protested that. And then I protested when he gave his State of the Union speech and said, if you have a better idea, let me know. So I brought materials down to let him know that the majority of Americans had a better idea, and was arrested trying to do that. So it was very disappointing. I think that, you know, he is just as, you know, the political process is broken. You know, it really is driven by the industries, and it doesn't matter who you put in there or what they know. They are not able to implement policy right now on the basis of sound evidence. And actually, Dr. Shiner was invited to the White House in April of 2010 for an ABC forum, and then had an interview the week before in Forbes magazine where he disagreed with the president's proposal, and he was disinvited from the White House.
Wow. And what you speak on right there, in terms of, you know, trying to deliver that letter and being arrested, I think that plays so much into the importance of October 6th, because, you know, as I saw Chris Hedges, his 3-minute piece on your website on October2011.org, it's going to take civil disobedience. I'm almost certain that it's going to take civil disobedience from thousands, tens of thousands, and if we can, hundreds of thousands of people just occupying Freedom Plaza for days and weeks, if possible, and just shutting it down, making it well known. I think that's the only language that these people are gonna even listen to. And I think that, unfortunately, like a lot of Americans, I think they have to see a mass mobilization of people to understand issues a little bit more critically and how vital they are. And so I think that this movement in of itself, not just is gonna garner a lot of attention from politicians, but more importantly, a lot of attention from the average, you know, American layperson, who is going to be intrigued by what's going on and what so many people are committed to do on the you know, for the betterment of the greater good of the mass of people, not the 2% and or 10% of the richest of the rich. So I really see it as this being a one of those historic moments in U.S. and possibly world history approaching in October. Dr. Flowers, the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, as we're looking at this debt crisis thing, we see today, you know, the stock market dropping another 440 plus points, maybe more than that now as we speak. That was, you know, earlier when I was reading the news,
right.
And we see that this so-called compromise, which is funny. You have these two corporate parties compromising, but what about the American people? What about the mass of American people that have no say whatsoever in this whole process? And a compromise for who? This is not a compromise for the mass of American people. This $2.5 plus trillion in cuts, how are these cuts going to affect Medicare, or how are they potentially going to affect Medicare and Medicaid down the line?
Right, that's a great question, and really looking at the big picture, you know, if you once you kind of pull back and look at the big picture, it's really very clear what is happening in this country. I think it's easy for people to get lost in the little details, but what we're seeing are manufactured crises. The debt crisis is a manufactured crisis, and it's being used as an excuse to cut our important social insurances. We knew beginning last year when President Obama created the National Commission for Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, looking at the people that he put on that committee, that was the direction that he wanted to take, was to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And so how does he get away with doing that? And we're seeing that play out now with these mandated cuts and the triggers and this secret super Congress that's going to meet in secret, and we don't even know who the lobbyists are that they're going to meet with. What they're going to be doing most likely is doing things like raising the age of eligibility for Medicare, so people have to wait longer, and people are already waiting, putting off care until they're eligible for Medicare. We're going to see them cutting reimbursements, and that means that you're cutting access, because when providers can't keep their offices open, or long-term healthcare facilities can't keep their doors open based on what they're being reimbursed from the system, then they're not able to see patients, and that cuts off access. We've seen willingness from the White House over the last year to allow more and more people to not be eligible for Medicaid, or to even privatize Medicaid and put that population into the private insurance pool instead of having a guaranteed public health insurance. So, these are real cuts that are going to lead to real suffering and real preventable deaths in this country, real human suffering. And it's all part of kind of this shock doctrine, neoliberal austerity agenda that we're seeing being put forth. And that's why we have to stop it.
You're exactly right. And you said preventable deaths. How many people would you say die each year because of lack of health insurance?
Well, there's a number of figures out there. I mean, one, there was a study done in 2009 that just looked at uninsured adults and how many of them died of preventable causes, and they found 45,000 of them did. That's just looking at adults without insurance, and that comes out to about 123 people a day, which that's pretty significant. You know, we don't see that on our headlines. We have another study from 2007 that said if the United States had a health system that was in one of the top three, we're currently 37th in the world, if we were in the top three, we would save over 101,000 lives every year. We know that 2 million people a year are diagnosed with cancer in this country and aren't able to afford the care that they need for that. So, you know, I hear stories all the time. I was down in Southern Maryland, and the medical examiner said that they found a 55-year-old man dead in his home who had undiagnosed colon cancer, untreated, undiagnosed, because he couldn't, you know, go to the doctor and get care for that. And we meet people everywhere who say, that they have to make choices between getting chemotherapy or paying for their children's college education. And what do? Do they sacrifice their life so their child may have a chance at a better life? This is the United States that we're talking about, you know. It's amazing that these things are happening here every day, such health injustice.
Right, and I'm looking at the website right now, Physicians for National Healthcare Program, and it's just like astonishing numbers that just jump out at the homepage. You know, $8,160 a year that it's spent by the U.S. Per capita, and it's twice as much as other industrialized nations, and which leaves $50.7 million Americans without healthcare coverage, and millions inadequately covered. And then lastly, this is unbelievable that a single-payer, nonprofit healthcare system would save more than $400 billion per year, enough to provide comprehensive, high-quality coverage for all Americans.
Absolutely.
That's amazing. How many doctors would you say support this kind of you know, some people would say, you know, utopian, but I believe that we have to be visionaries. We have to dream of a utopian society in order to reach it. How many physicians do you think nationwide, you know, support this kind of single-payer national health insurance?
Well, and let's realize that it's not utopian, because every other industrialized nation does it. We're the abnormal nation that doesn't have a universal health system. So actually, like the majority of people in the United States, the majority of physicians in the United States support a national health program. There are a couple of nationwide polls that were done. One was in 2002 and one was in 2007. And those were of doctors across the nation of all different specialties. In 2002, 49% of physicians in the country supported a national health program. 5 years later, in 2007, it was up 10% to 59% of physicians supporting this approach, and we know that it's jumped since then. I meet doctors everywhere that I go, and doctors are burning out so quickly. They're so frustrated not being able to deliver care or take care of patients, you know, the way that they should in this country. We're losing our primary care doctors, and you know, this is just not a sustainable situation that we're in right now.
Right. That's goodness gracious. I just have a couple more questions for you, and I really, you know, we thank you so much for the time that you've given. It's not every day that we have an actual doctor that has it on our program, and especially a doctor like yourself. And I know that right now, currently, we have a lot of listeners right now who are in the medical profession as fledgling nurses. And my question for you is, as a community doctor, what, you know, if you could take us into your day-to-day profession, like, or not even your profession, but how you practice medicine. You say you're a community doctor. What are some of the things that you try to provide or try to do differently that are kind of outside the norm of how U.S. medicine is practiced, towards, you know, really placing a premium on the patient and the human life attached to that?
Right. Well, actually, you know, I actually left practice 4 years ago to do the advocacy work full time, because I felt that I was trying to do both, and that wasn't serving my patients well, and it wasn't allowing me to actually make a change with the advocacy work that I'm doing. But when I was practicing, you know, what we do as doctors, and I talk to doctors all of the time that are still in practice, and they're doing the same things that I was doing back then, which is you have to try to play the game. It's very demoralizing. You see your patient, you know what the treatment is that they need, you and your patient decide on what they need, and then you have to figure out how to maneuver the system so that they can get it. So what is it that you write down in the charts? And some doctors, many doctors, are not even writing in the charts. They use code words now, or don't put things in the chart, because they know that if they do and an insurance company sees it, it's going to be harmful to their patients. And that really undermines the integrity of a physician. You can't even be honest in the chart about your patient's situation. And then Every day you're making an economic decision with your patient. So you see them and determine what they need, and the next discussion has to be, how can you afford this? How can you afford this medication or the physical therapy that you need or the surgery that you need? Is this more important than paying the rent on your apartment, you know, or feeding your family or getting your car fixed? These are not discussions that, you know, physicians and patients should have to have in this country. And you mentioned that people that were inadequately insured, you know that the majority of bankruptcies in this country are due to medical costs, and 78% of people that have bankruptcy due to medical costs have health insurance, but it wasn't adequate to meet their needs when they had a serious problem.
Jeez. You said 78% of bankruptcies are caused...
It's 62% of bankruptcies, personal bankruptcies, are caused by medical illness, and 78%, almost 80% of those people that have a medical bankruptcy had health insurance when they became ill or had their accident.
Oh my Lord, that's amazing. Andre, I know you have a question.
I wanted to ask you about the House Resolution 676, the campaign that you have. If you could just speak a little bit on that.
Thank you. Yes, healthcarenow.org, which you mentioned, healthcare-now.org, is a national grassroots movement that was born in 2003 at the same time as H.R. 676 to support that legislation. It's a bill that's been introduced every session since then by Chairman John Conyers and has had as many as over 100 co-sponsors in the past. It's also known as the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, and it would create a health system in this country that was completely universal, comprehensive, publicly financed, accountable to the people, transparent, all of the principles that we put forth in Physicians for a National Health Program are met by this piece of legislation. So we support it, and we were, you know, trying to push it through during the health reform process in 2009 and 2010. And so if people want to learn more about it, you can go to healthcare-now.org. You can, you know, find out what groups in your area are involved. Maryland has a chapter of Healthcare Now that's very active. And you can go to the Library of Congress website and read H.R. 676. It's really simple to read. That's the beauty of it. And see just what does this mean, a national health program.
Right. Thank you. And for our last question, I have a doozy for you, just because it's a quasi-loaded question. But my last question for you is for folks listening right now, and I guess on two different tiers, people who are in the medical profession as well as people, because I know that there are some people listening right now that are in the medical profession and are tuning in right now because they were so eager to hear you speak, you know, mostly nurses that I know. And then there are, you know, just regular non-medical professionals like myself and Andrea who are tuned in right now. But first and foremost, what kind of advice would you give for a healthcare professional, a nurse or a newly anointed physician who has recently taken the Hippocratic Oath, in terms of, and they want to make a change. They want to, they see the need for this kind of healthcare system. And like you were right, it's not utopian. It's being done across the world with countries that, quite frankly, have just a fraction of the overall annual budget that the U.S. Carries with it. What kind of advice could you give them in terms of how they can get involved, how they can support this kind of system, within by maneuvering within their day-to-day work, whether it's in a hospital or a clinic, and then also what can people like myself do to support this?
Thank you. So a big part of the reason that I do this work is that I just find the current situation completely unacceptable. The fact that we're already spending enough money in this country to provide high-quality, comprehensive care to everybody, but we aren't doing it is unacceptable to me. And so I really see it as my professional responsibility as a physician who advocates for the best for patients to do this work. I cannot be silent in the face of this situation and the huge toll that it's taking in terms of suffering and preventable deaths and bankruptcy and foreclosure in this country. So I would urge every health professional and every person to get involved, to educate themselves, and to start looking around, because health injustice is happening in this country over and over every day, but we don't realize it because we don't know what that alternative is that every other industrialized nation has. So it's important to not be silent. In your hospital, if you see the hospital cutting corners, if you see that they're not staffing adequately for high-quality patient care, you've got to speak out and demand that that be changed. If you see community clinics or hospitals being closed, you need to fight to keep them open. You need to fight to keep Medicare and Medicaid from being cut. And a big thing is educating yourself, and you can do that through Physicians for National Health Program, the website, which is pnhp.org. There's lots of materials. If you're new to single payer, you can click on new to single payer. You can, you know, get involved, join the organization. You don't have to be a physician. If you're a health professional or somebody who advocates for healthcare, you can join the organization, or you can join healthcare-now.org. Organize in your area, educate those around you. But I think that, you know, as I said earlier, each of the issues that we have, each of the crises in this country that we're facing have these solutions. But separately, we're not going to be able to have the power to overcome this corporate control of our political process. So I really urge people to join the October 2011 movement, to spread the word, and to stand with us or support us in Washington, D.C. as we, you know, demand these changes that we as people require.
Right, and how can people get in contact with you via email if they want to, you know, pick your brain or just for whatever reason?
Sure. Well, you know, a lot of the information and questions can be answered through the website, and then we also have the Maryland Healthcare Now chapter, and that website is MD as in Maryland, mdsinglepayer.org, and you can join the local meetings that are going on through Maryland Healthcare Now. If you need to reach me, I can be reached at margaret@pnhp.org, and I'll do my best to respond. I have to say that organizing for the October 2011 movement has become a 24/7 endeavor, but I'll do my best to respond to you if you email me at margaret@pnhp.org.
Thank you, and I just want to thank you on behalf of Your World News for coming on and spending this time with us. And most importantly, thank you for the work that you're doing on behalf of humanity. I'll just leave it at that, you know, because the work that you're doing as a medical professional advocate for a single payer, and also the organizing around, as an organizer myself, I know how difficult it is to organize and something on the scale of what I believe the October 6th movement is going to be like is a night and day jobs, and you being a mother of three, just thank you so much for advocating on and fighting on behalf of humanity and being the visionary we need to see a better society, free of war, free of imperialism, free of racism and sexism and corporatism. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Solomon and Andrea. I really enjoyed it, and thank you for the work that you do, because I know that you are an important voice for those who are not otherwise heard, and that's so crucial in this time. Thank you.
No problem. Take care.
Take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Andrea, that was. I'm going to get your thoughts in a second. I'm just going to have a brief musical interlude because I need to digest a lot of that. That was a powerful interview, and I'm just going to have this a brief musical interlude, and on the other end, we'll be joined by Andrea and myself and anyone that wants to call in now. If you want to choose to call in at 347-945-5191, once again, that's 347-945-5191. That is our hotline, not the bat line, that's the black line, B-L-A-C-K, the black line. So you can call in right now. You don't have to be black. But it's the black line, all right? You know, so on this show, we things that are black are not bad. So the black cat is your friend. Angel food cake is not your friend. Devil's food cake, black, you know, I don't know, I'm getting carried away. But anyways, you get the point. So we're going to take a musical interlude, and when we come back, we'll get your thoughts, Andre, and hopefully we'll get the thoughts of anyone that is that chooses to call in. I see we've got a lot of listeners on the switchboard, and no pressure. If you don't want to call in, that's fine, but if you do, you're more than welcome. This is home.
What? Wanna see my ID?
In America.
Born West Philly.
In America.
Days overseas.
In America.
African in my jeans.
In America.
Said I'm sick of police, I don't got any beef, so why they wanna beat me?
In America.
They kill the natives with disease, smallpox and sheep, African and Chinese.
In America.
Young soldiers go die.
In America.
Unemployment too high.
In America.
Got the prisons real big.
In America.
Thanks, feel weird.
In America.
A lot of guns okay, and they sick to play, they steal the money all day.
In America.
Don't get paid, 98 in the shade, and life feel like a maid.
In America.
I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know, be self-evident that there is power in numbers.
I say you shit ain't sweet, man, they live on the street, but now nothing to eat.
In America.
And many kids fool by, all the TV style, you see a pretty drive by.
In America.
But who can live like that?
In America.
How many live like that?
In America.
I never lived like that.
In America.
Nobody lives like that.
In America.
You and I have never seen.
That was Zion I. That was Zion I in America. In America. Yes, corporatism in America. Institutional racism and white supremacy in America. Profit healthcare or profit-driven healthcare system that kills tens of thousands in America. So anyways, Andrea, your thoughts. Go.
You know, as someone who works in a community clinic, it's very refreshing to hear Dr. Flowers. And honestly, I didn't realize how many physicians were behind single payer healthcare. And so it's very refreshing to see that because you know what I've seen in my time working in this community clinic and even just within in nonprofits in general. It says it's a nonprofit, but a lot of times it really starts to look like a corporation. And the grants and the funding that nonprofits get are oftentimes from other, you know, private companies that want to push a specific agenda in that nonprofit, and it ends up getting co-opted. And so it's, you know, we wouldn't need a ton of community clinics, you know, in the form that they exist now, if we had universal health care and it was able to function appropriately. But it's refreshing to hear a doctor speak that way. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, and it's crazy because it, you know, even these small business owners who allow their minds to be controlled and manipulated by the corporate media and by politicians that, quite frankly, they don't have the people's best interests at heart. They have the corporation's best interests at heart. It's just puzzling to see, you know, so many small business owners not be behind a single payer system because it would save them so much money. Andre, it would save them so much money because instead of spending, some cases, you know, tens of thousands or six figures a year on health care for their employees, they wouldn't have to worry about that because health care would be taken care of by the state, by the U.S. government itself. It would be funded by the U.S. health, so they would be saving so much money on the front and the back end, and it's crazy. And then also on top of that, having so many of those folks, man, from like red states that are, you know, living in trailer parks and are poor as hell and missing you know teeth and grandma's got a hernia, she has a busted gut and a whole bunch of other ailments, and it's just getting worse because, you know, they don't have any health care and they're sitting there, Andrea, and we heard it, we saw it, Andrea. We see them getting out, you know, I don't want no socialism, no socialized health care. I don't want no socialized health care, you're gonna force that socialized health care on me. But you know what? but it's okay. You dumbass, it's okay to force, carcinogen-laced food on you, isn't it? It's okay to force that damn, you know, cancerous food down your bloody throat and your kids' bloody throats as well, you know, that's going to lead them to an early death as well, you know, and having these super expensive pharmaceutical drugs, you know, forced on you just to sustain your life if you can afford them. That's okay, right? You know, and not even ever thinking about these things, Andrea. And so it's like, it's almost like we talk all the time, though, critical thought. Americans don't critically think. Well, Americans don't think in general. They don't, many Americans just don't think in general. And you know, what they do think, it's been manufactured. Their mode of thought has been provided by the educational system in the U.S., and I'm a strong supporter for public education, a healthy public education that is financed by the state itself. Call me a socialist. Yeah, you're damn right I'm a socialist. I am a socialist. But when I say a healthy educational system, I'm talking about a healthy education that no matter whether you go into an Auckland community or an inner city community, you have a thriving educational system there. You have schools that challenge students, that embrace innovative and new teaching pedagogical philosophies. You have manageable classrooms with enough books, and you have critical thought and media literacy that is a part of the day-to-day curriculum for these children. That's the kind of public education that I support. But, you know, Andrea, they've been taught what to think from cradle to grave, and it's just sick. And I'm so glad, like she mentioned that. I mean, the ingredients. I mean, Andrea, she just told you, she broke out, and I'm telling you, this is true. I've been out there to Western Europe. I've been there and I've seen it. When I was in Norway, you go to the grocery stores and you don't see these like litany of white breads. You see whole grain breads. And so when she was telling you that chemicals have to be run through a gambit, they have to be run through a gambit of tests and approvals, and before they can be put into foods. And if the chemicals have carcinogens in them, and if they have cancer-causing agents in them, they don't get put in the food. They don't get put in the food. But here we have hydrogenated oils that are in so many foods. You have to go through and you have to read the ingredients. There's a great documentary out called Ingredients that folks should definitely watch, as well as Food Incorporated. And you can watch Food Incorporated for free at Hulu. Just go to Hulu.com. It's not a plug for Hulu. It's a plug for the information that's in Food Inc. But Andrea, we've had many of these conversations. I mean, for God's sakes, we've been a part of trying to educate students, college students, as to how to eat properly and how to support sustainable foods, fair trade foods, and how to advocate on behalf of poor communities that don't have the whole foods option. I was just talking to somebody today, matter of fact, you go into poor communities And until white folks start to move into these communities, and when they move into these communities, that means that black folks are being moved out of the communities. Latino folks are being moved out of the communities. It's called gentrification, ethnic cleansing. That's the time that you see the Whole Foods corporation moving in. You see the Whole Foods grocery store moving in. You see the organic foods stores moving in. And so that's also a part of institutional racism in this country. It's planned, you know, obsolescence. And black folks and Latino folks we're obsolete in this country. We're only to be used as a exploitable labor force. And then when we die, we can be replaced by our children and so forth and so forth. Andrea, we have a caller. I want to take this call real quickly. We have about 20 minutes left. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a quick question or comment?
Solo, how are you and Andrea?
Oh,
hi, sir.
Long time no hear from you all.
Yeah, we had to take a break. After a while, as you know, if you don't recharge your batteries,
being a black
or brown skin person in this country, white supremacy in America starts to weigh your bloody back, and you have to kind of escape and go and recharge yourself and retool. And that's what we did. We retooled, and now we're back better than before.
Well, I am so glad to hear you. You guys are on the air, especially your topic that you were speaking of with this food, because I don't know if you touched on it with Cargill having that massive recall on their turkey. Did you touch on that?
No.
Well, they were on the news at Cargill on salmonella poisoning, so they're having this massive recall of millions of pounds of turkey that's sold throughout the country, that they're telling people that they need to they're going to be doing a recall on it.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So this is what it's telling us, you know, when we have our food is in the hands of people like Monsanto, Cargill, ADM, and all of these people who, you know, it's in the hands of just maybe four or five major corporations that controls the food supply in this country. Mm-hmm. And this is what will happen with poisoning.
Right.
Absolutely.
I totally agree. And yeah, you're right. Monsanto is an evil corporation. I said it. Sarah said it. Monsanto is an evil, vile, and same with Cargill. But Monsanto is like, I mean, in terms of the evil corporations, they are one of the ones that reign supreme at the top. They are vile, and if there was any kind of justice whatsoever, the CEOs and the board of directors for Monsanto would be put behind bars for life. For life.
Death, like they were doing in China.
For life.
They would shoot them to death.
Yep. Yeah, they sure would, yeah.
Because don't forget that Clarence Thomas, he was an attorney for Monsanto. That's how come he got recognized. That's how come he's sitting on the courts right now.
Right.
I wish you could put history on him one of these days, if you ever get a chance to do a run through and let the people know that he was an attorney for Monsanto. He was recognized because Senator John Danforth of Missouri and all of the shenanigans that went on with a particular case, that is Clarence Thomas, because he used to be from being an attorney for Monsanto. He moved on to the attorney general was an assistant attorney general for the state of Missouri, and that's how come he got his behind on into Washington.
Right, you're right. You're exactly right.
And how he managed to move up the food chain so very fast. But y'all are doing a fantastic program. I'm going to have to listen from the beginning because I didn't know y'all were. I just happened to click on my computer and I got the email that y'all were doing a show. And when I saw on the food situation, I said I had to call because I was just reading the debacle with Cargill and what they were doing with the recall of all of their turkey products that they were telling people, you know, to go ahead between March and July. If you bought turkey, then you need to go ahead and check the packaging and go ahead and just return it back to the stores and get your money back.
You're exactly right. And you're going to love, when you listen to the beginning of the show, you're going to love the show, because we had a doctor, a medical doctor on who was not, you know, your typical, you know, doctor that we think of coming from, you know, U.S. trained educational systems, but she's a strong supporter of universal single payer healthcare system, has been arrested protesting on behalf of that, and she spoke on a number of things that I know that you're gonna really find a lot of usefulness out of her words and out of the information.
Isn't she one of those that were protesting with this with a health care bill last year? Because I know the name sounds familiar, Margaret Flowers.
Yes. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, she tried to deliver a letter to Obama on the floor of
the
Capitol and was arrested. Yes.
Yeah, I knew the name sounded familiar. But quickly, y'all are doing a great job. And when you get a chance, because this food insecurity, and I hope that you do a special on this program with this starvation and what's going on in Somalia. I know all of these corporations, especially schools, are having these large endowments in Africa, how they're buying up large swaths of land and evicting these people off their land, blocking the flow of water, and that's what's creating this massive famine that's going on in East Africa right now. This is something we need to address.
Right. Yes, we covered that a little bit in the beginning, and because of you, right now, you know, we're going to actually turn to a news bit on Somalia right now on the ongoing drought. So thanks for that.
Let me get off line.
Thank you, sir.
We're very limited in the amount of time you have left. Thanks again.
Okay. All right. No problem.
Okay.
Andre, I'm going to go with this really quickly, and I want to get your thoughts on some more thoughts on food, because I know that you're have been a long-time supporter of fair trade, but you know, and more importantly, you know, food justice, been a supporter of food justice. I'll just leave it that way.
At least 10 million people are in danger of starvation in Kenya, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Somalia under the worst drought conditions in 60 years. This should be taken as fact. But when it comes to which humans are to blame for relief supplies being unavailable to the victims, don't believe a word that the United States government says. Washington is not only the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, it is also the biggest liar on the planet, none of whose words can be taken at face value. The Americans claim the Shabab Islamist fighters made the drought crisis worse by preventing international aid agencies from distributing food relief. But only last year, in February 2010, the New York Times was running a headline, UN officials assail U.S. for withholding Somali aid. We explored that story in Black Agenda Report. Back then, United Nations officials charged the U.S. with imposing conditions that made it impossible to deliver tens of millions in food aid to hungry Somalis. The Americans refused to allow food to be transferred from warehouses in Kenya, claiming it might enrich the coffers of the Shabab, who controlled about half of Somalia. The U.S. finally let some food pass through, but only on the condition that aid workers not pay any fees at Shabab checkpoints around the country. Aid workers on the ground said that following U.S. orders would make them look like spies. Apparently, they were right. It was a clear case of the United States using food as a weapon of war, starving the people of Somalia in order to destroy the social base for the resistance to U.S. proxy rule over that country. We do know that the relationship between the Shabab and international aid agencies fell apart at that point, so one could conclude that Washington succeeded in its mission. Starving people are now paying the price. The U.S.-backed puppet government in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, waited until this week to declare a drought emergency in Somalia. Kenya, another American puppet, refused to allow Somalis to enter a brand new and empty refugee camp. Ethiopia may be the worst case. Not only did it bring on what was then Africa's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN, by invading the country in late 2006 at the instigation of the United States, Ethiopia has virtually sealed off its vast Ogaden region to outside observers. And a look at the map of the drought-stricken areas shows that the Ogaden is a center of the crisis. The Ogaden is populated by ethnic Somalis who've been fighting their own guerrilla war against the Ethiopian dictatorship, whom they charge with using food as a weapon of war. Of the 10 million people at risk of starvation, a huge portion live or are now dying in the Ogaden. As the dependable Thomas C. Mountain reports from nearby Eritrea, the Ethiopian government has blocked the International Red Cross and other aid agencies from carrying out relief work in the region. The Obama administration, which now gives the Ethiopian dictatorship more money than any regime in Africa, could force the doors to the Ogaden open with one phone call. But it won't, because Ethiopia and the U.S. are on the same mission, and there is nothing humanitarian about it. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Wow, that's one of those voices you just can't, you can never forget. Glenn Ford making it plain. Andrea, if you want to touch on, I guess, anything that was just said by Glenn Ford, but also, continue what we were talking about with the, the food supply in the U.S. and, you know, all the hormones and carcinogens that are riddled through candy and cereal and, you know, just all that kind of stuff. What's your thoughts?
If I am not mistaken, I believe he said 10 million people on the verge of starvation.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. And so I just want to highlight that because I think that it's important for us to really, you know, sometimes through news we hear so many numbers and statistics and you kind of just like become desensitized to these things. But I think it's really important that we start to tune in to these things, to these numbers, because these are human beings that are starving. And even if just one person, if we can personalize things as much as possible so that we can really understand the depth of these issues, I think that we would, you know, be much more motivated to work to alleviate these problems. You know, if you could just imagine one person in your life that's close to you starving and the pain that would cause them and yourself seeing that, you know, I think that it really puts into perspective, you know, what this issue is and y'all, like 10 million people. I mean, you know, I just, that really stuck with me, and I think that those numbers are often overlooked, and we really need to make ourselves more aware and more conscious of how deep these problems are. But to go back to the food supply in the U.S., I'll just say that, and I was trying to find the website. I can't remember what organization does this, but we have to understand, too, that government organizations in general, but particularly the FDA, has a lot of people on their board that are part of corporations. And so that is why we see certain medications and certain foods being approved when they shouldn't be, when they have not been in other industrialized countries, because the research has clearly shown that they're not safe and they're not healthy for human consumption. So I think that a lot of times we see, you know, FDA-approved labels and we feel comfortable, and I think that, you know, we have to be really, really careful with that, because if this was a country where corporatism and government were separate, which it's not, this is a fascist state, then we wouldn't have to be concerned about, you know, not trusting labels approved by the government. But, this is a time where we must be concerned, we must question that, and look at alternative organizations that are really not funded by corporations who have the best interests of human beings, a number of fair trade groups. And making sure that, you know, products are certified fair trade and, particular organic, organizations that also certify that something is organic. And so, you know, I mean, it's a huge movement here, and, there's all these code words that corporations use to get around, making their food organic, but really pushing that brand of organic in the U.S., you know, things like It's Natural or 70% organic. And so I think it's important for us to, you know, educate ourselves. And then it's almost like this game where you have to, you know, learn the codes and so that you can be a conscious consumer. And it definitely shouldn't have to be that way, but unfortunately it is. And I think that you know, a lot of times I'm in D.C. and I'm just driving around, and I realize, like, it's so complicated to just get a meal where you know that the meat or the chicken or the fish that you're eating doesn't have mercury or, it has animals that have been, they're cage-free and have been fed grass and not, some kind of corn feed. And I just think that that's so sad. And beyond sad, it's disturbing that, where that's where we're at in this country, you know, where you have to actively seek small, independent co-ops for you to be able to have healthy food that, it's just grown how food used to be grown, maybe not even 100 years ago food was grown and there were none of these labels attached to it. And somehow there's this culture where if you speak about this, people are kind of like, oh, you're really obsessed about your food and you're really particular about what you eat. And it's like, well, you kind of have to be that way now. You know, it's not like it's something that you choose to be, like you want to be annoying, but it's really a health concern and it's really serious. And unfortunately, it's not something that a lot of people are able to do because it is a privilege to know, what is good to eat. And even just like you were talking about earlier, to have access to these foods. And so I think a lot of times I hear some nutritionists speak about how maybe Black and Latino people don't know how to eat. And it's not that you don't know how to eat. It's what you have access to. And so if a grocery store that sells, a co-op that sells, organic produce is miles away and you don't have a car and you can't pay for it anyways because usually it's more expensive than non-organic produce, you're just not going to do it because you don't have enough money to, take the bus and then even just pay for the food. And so I think that it's, like you said, it's an issue also of institutionalized racism where you can't, you have to be a conscious consumer, and yes, there's a level of individual responsibility, but it's also a systematic problem.
Right. And so I want to end on the show, by saying, folks, they're listening right now, whether it's on live or archives, we have to, because I believe everyone listening right now in some shape, form, or fashion is privileged to a certain extent. And so for the masses of people in this country and in the world who, even if they wanted to listen to this show right now, they have no access to listen to this show because they don't have a computer or what have you. They're homeless. They're in a developing nation that has continued to be exploited by the Western world. We have to advocate on their behalf. It's even bigger than that. You have to put yourself in their shoes. You literally have to put yourself in their shoes, and you have to push yourself to put yourselves in their shoes. All right. And I'm quite certain when we force ourselves, because I don't trust enough of us to actually think, to think on people's behalves, because unfortunately, when you tell people to do that, it still leaves them, kind of, I wouldn't say apathetic, but just like, oh, I heard the show and I'm going to go back to my regular life. This show is not for you to go back to your regular life. I didn't start this show for people to listen and go back to their regular life. I started this show to make a difference, to provide news and information, to elevate the specter of consciousness for people that are listening, people that are driven about by collectively creating a better society. And so you cannot continue to listen to this show and go back to your regular life. If that's the case, don't do it. I want people to go to listen to this show and to go into their communities and start doing something. Lay in bed tonight. When you lay on your back, if you cannot sleep for whatever reason, you lay on your back and you think of what you can do tomorrow to make a deeper impact, whether it's in your job, whether it's in your household, whether it's in your community. What can you do? If you know this information is not being provided to kids or, and you're a soccer coach or whatever, find little ways to engage children. I think it's completely bullshit for anyone to think that you cannot introduce certain things like this certain subject matter to young kids. I believe that you can make it very palatable, you know, so, you know, that's something I'm a strong advocate for, you know, to have, you know, so, yeah, you might not just be able to jump in and talk about, you know, Columbus, you know, raping and mutilating, you know, AIRWAC, you know, women, you know, and boys, but you can, you know, talk to children and say, hey, you know, before, you know, people from Europe came to this land, this land was populated by tens of millions of indigenous people, and this is how they lived, and this is how beautiful it was. We have to think on these things. We have to think on these kind of scales. What can we do better? This is what this show is about. This is what Your World News is about. This is what we as human beings that see things in a different manner, that those of us that are progressive and those of us who are radical must see things, because otherwise get the hell away from that title being a radical or progressive if you're not pushing yourself to see and do things in a different way. So that's the last word. This has been Your World News on behalf of Andres Zamudio, and props out to Pedro Zamudio. Props out to the parents of Andre. What's your mom's name again? I keep forgetting.
Amanda.
What's your mom? Amanda and Pedro Zamudio, for faithful listeners. Thanks for listening, Pedro. As you're listening right now, I know you got a smile from ear to ear. You must be so proud of your daughter for doing the great work that she's doing. And my props to you and your wife, your lovely wife Amanda, for you know, for being such great parents and producing someone like Andrea on this planet. And I got to give props out. So that's my props out today to Pedro and Amanda. I hope you're smiling now. And until later, we got to keep fighting. We have to keep fighting, and pushing the envelope as far as we effing can. All right, so I hope to see some of you out on October 6th. At the October 6th movement, that's October2011.org. And for Your World News, this is Solo, and peace, and we're out of here.